I'm Chris Voss, sitting here with Sarah Darling, a member of Boston's premier chamber orchestra, a far cry. She is, as they lovingly refer to themselves, a crier. And she's here with me in studio to discuss their concert dedicated to music from England, a concert they titled Albion, and a concert which she curated. Sarah Darling, thank you very much for taking the time.
My pleasure. It's fantastic to be here.
So we're going to get to all this fabulous music that's on this concert in a second. But first, I just want to take a moment and ask you what that means that you curated this concert. How does that fit into the fabric of what a far cry is? And what does it mean that you had to do to curate this concert?
We call ourselves a self-conducted orchestra, and it means a bunch of different things. But it comes down to a certain kind of responsibility that every member has the privilege of taking on. It's not that we're lacking a conductor. We kind of gave up the word conductorless years ago because, in fact, leadership is something that we kind of engender in ourselves and empower in each other all the time. It's just that we're all leaders. And, of course, you can't always have everybody being a leader all the time. So what that means is that we essentially take turns. And one of the things that we take turns in doing is taking on the artistic responsibility of coming up with an evening's entertainment.
How did you guys decide on dedicating an evening exclusively to English music?
It was sort of a happy accident. I had two secret missions, and they found each other in England. The first was that I was dying for us to play with Nick. Every time I hear him sing, I think, oh my God, this is a musician's musician. The storytelling, the incredible loving attention to detail. I knew that if he and A Far Cry were together, it would be this kind of rocking week of really fun music, and that has in fact come true. So that was part of it. And the other part of it is that the group has been dying to play the Britten Serenade for tenor, horn, and strings.
Is this true? This was the only major work for strings that you guys hadn't done in your 10, 11 years together?
It's probably not strictly speaking true, but it's been something that we've been attempting to program 5-6 years now. I should mention, going back to the way that we program, that it's not that we get like assigned a particular concert. Rather, what it is that before every season, you can create as many programs as you want. But what ends up happening is eventually everybody kind of goes in a corner and comes out with a few programs. We present them to each other. There'll be this sort of parade of Google Sheets. And then we start the long process of figuring out from these different programs, which ones are we the most excited about? And then from there as well, of course, which ones are going to fit coherently into a season? You know, this program has been on my mind for a few years now. There are also several other programs in what we call the vault that also have that Britten Serenade on them. And, you know, sooner or later we'll return to it and present it in a completely different guise, and that'll be fun too.
You challenged concertgoers to enjoy the language of this as well. What is it about how Britten sets the language that is inspiring and made you excited about this concert?
Oh, gosh. Britten, yeah. The way that he approaches the language, it's funny. It first becomes clear to you as a listener. He has favorite words and favorite phrases, and they're usually, yeah, they're usually, I think, sort of the standout phrases in the poem, and he will make sure that you don't miss them. For instance, in the very first poem, which describes the feeling at the close of day, everything's kind of winding down and the shadows are getting so long that the shadows are turning everything that would usually be sort of small and diminutive is casting these massive shadows. And so he says, look at the ant. The ant is like a monstrous elephant. And in that moment, in Britten's setting, until now we've been sort of playing this lovely sort of calming figure, and then the orchestra just sort of stops for a second. The singer says, monstrous elephant.
Monstrous elephant.
And then you pick up and you keep going. But that just, Britten has designed it so that that will sit in your head like a stone.
Well, so as is your way, you do a lot of known and unknown works on this concert. You have, if you're going to do an evening dedicated to English music, you got to have Henry Purcell. But you don't only do Henry Purcell on this concert. You also include other English composers from that time, from the 1500s, 1600s, including Matthew Locke, who might be a little bit less well-known.
Including Matthew Locke, whose music to The Tempest was one of the first pieces of early music to blow my brain wide open.
Why is that?
It's because, in particular, so it's incidental music to the Shakespeare play, and there's a ton of it. There are, you know, dances, there's this and that. But then there's a curtain tune which describes The Tempest itself. And, I mean, you'll hear when you hear this thing, he uses dissonance in this sort of terrifying way to show you where the storm is coming from. So you're like, you're there on stage and you can see the storm coming in and you can kind of feel that it's still very calm in the air, but the, like all the blades of grass are trembling. And then you sort of see it. And rhythmically, he moves from something which starts very, very slowly to something which by the time you're in the middle of it, it's going like 95 miles an hour and the winds are whipping around. And people just weren't doing that yet. I mean, this is like, this is a tone poem. And tone poems were still like 300 years off.
Yeah.
So so I was very excited to get some Locke on there, along with Purcell and along with the beautiful songs that Nick sings in this first set. We sort of devised it as a kind of an emotional arc. So he sings a little and then the orchestra kind of responds and then he sings some more and the orchestra responds and things keep shifting depending on what we're doing.
What is it about Henry Purcell and his setting of the English language in particular that you find is unique and has made him such a pillar for English music?
Oh, that's an easy question. gosh, what is it? This is one of these moments where, as a musician, you sort of intuitively immediately know the answer. As a voice on the radio, I'm sitting here thinking, how do I put it into words?
I've always found that I love how Henry takes the English language, which seems to not really fit all that well into this style of music, especially a style that sort of started in Italy and that beautiful lyric language.
Sure.
And yet he has a brilliant way of taking the words and picking the right ones in which to spend some time on,
mm-hmm.
and getting you to get the idea of what he wants you to feel.
Totally. One thing that's drove me crazy when I first, in a good way, when I first started listening to Purcell, I got to know Dido and Aeneas by playing it. And so I was playing this opera, listening to these songs, which, as you say, like linger on just the right notes. Ah, Belinda, I am pressed with torments, not to be confessed. And it was only much later when I looked at the libretto, which I realized to my great shock fit on one page and just goes, ah, Belinda, I am pressed with torment, not to be confessed. Like, ah, but that's not what he's doing at all in the phrases.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. It's like he's just superimposing an entirely different reality onto these words.
You are, aside from playing with a Far Cry, you are also an early music musician. You play with the Baroque viola as well. Am mm-hmm. I correct about that?
Baroque viola, Baroque violin, put it in my hands and I'll try
gamut.
To do something with it.
How is playing this music different playing on a modern instrument than it is playing in the early music instrument? How does it feel different playing something by Purcell or by Locke?
It's harder.
Yeah?
Just straight up, it's harder. The great thing about early instruments is that they do the work for you. They sort of take you by the hand and just lead you into the realm. It would be like, I mean, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that it's like dancing without having your dancing shoes. You know, I might, you put on dancing shoes and you go to pivot and you just immediately pivot to exactly where you need to go. You try to pivot wearing sneakers, you can do it. You could do it for sure, but man, it's a lot harder. And so with a modern bow, to get that sort of that rhetorical sleight of hand, that sort of brilliance, it's something that you can manage, but you're going to use a lot more muscle groups to make it happen.
On this concert as well is Vaughan Williams' Concerto Grosso, a style of music that developed maybe just after just after Purcell was writing.
Yeah, yeah.
But is in the same sound world. But Vaughan Williams, writing in the 20th century, is doing something different with it. I have two questions here. How does Vaughan Williams' Concerto Grosso sort of fit into the idea of the Concerto Grosso as a genre? And also, why did you guys go with the Concerto Grosso by Vaughan Williams as a string orchestra? You could have done any of the lovely, lush string music that Vaughan Williams has written, but you went with something that maybe isn't as performed as those other things, like A Lark Ascending or something like that.
Totally, totally. Really, very specifically, because we were looking for something to bridge that gap. So, you know, you start with very early music, you end with something which is kind of profoundly 20th century. But for the Vaughan Williams, the idea was I was looking for a piece that would kind of bridge this gap by referring back to an old idiom. And you can hear that although he refers to the old idiom in the way that he uses the forces, this piece actually was originally written for a massive school orchestra of vastly differing abilities. And in a way, I kind of wish we could have had like the 200 people on stage that were at the original, because he set it up so that the concertino, the most sort of intricate writing, is performed kind of by the central circle. And then you've got the ripieno sort of filling things out and creating heft. But in the original, he also had parts for people who only played open strings.
Oh, that's lovely.
And you can hear it from time to time. For instance, at the beginning of the second movement, the theme bum 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 is not quite right, but it's something like that. And you can just imagine 200 people only playing on open strings to make it happen. And then the concertino comes in and goes straight back into more complicated music. So yeah, it's kind of a standout piece in many ways, and it is a little bit of a curiosity.
I want to go away from the music and talk about you guys as an organization a little bit. So you've been together for just over a decade now, what, 11 years now,
yeah.
Right? You celebrated 10 years last year, right?
Yep, we're 10 years old. We're entering into our teens. God help us.
Isn't that wild? And so I want to ask about that, because you have developed this reputation for having incredibly innovative programming and extremely engaging performances. But I wonder, how do you keep that going,
it's
do you think?
It's funny how we have been asking ourselves that question, not just in the last couple of years, but through the entire time that we've been alive. And there are a lot of different potential answers to the question, but it comes down to, it's a very simple question in the end. It's the same question of, like, why do you get up every morning? You know, you get up every morning because why wouldn't you want to? The world is out there. There's so much to experience. And yeah, for us, it feels as though there are just kind of endless opportunities to do different things, but also to do the same things in a different way, to do the same things better, to sort of strive for something a little bit different, to strive to become better musicians individually and collectively, to understand each other better as we also continue to grow. I mean, we're growing as an organization, but we're also growing as individuals. It's a very different thing to hang out in an orchestra of 30-somethings versus an orchestra of 20-somethings.
Mm-hmm.
There are babies, for instance. And it just, you know, we know different things. I described it once, and I really feel this is true, that sort of the longer your feet are on the ground in this world, the greater repertoire of sounds you have access to. So
in what way?
Anything,
what do you mean?
In our 20s, we were often described as being a sort of a high energy group. And while I think that energy hasn't gone anywhere, when people react to us now, they often sort of describe something which is closer to subtlety. And I think, gosh.
I mean, that sounds like a description of maturity.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to put into a few words, but I think that kind of every day that we're alive brings us some kind of additional richness, whether that be a sort of a positive or a negative, and you can use it all. I mean, that's your privilege as an artist, is to be able to use absolutely everything that comes to you, in one way or another.
I wanted to ask you one more thing, and it's maybe more generally about classical music organizations. There's a lot of conversation going on right now about diversity, about inclusion, about increasing, for example, the number of female composers and conductors that are in groups, and people of color, and more living composers. Now, you guys are very good at this because I feel like it's part of your blood is to be diverse in that way. But do you think that what you guys are doing is in a way starting to become closer to the norm? Do you think it will become the norm? Are you feeling like maybe you guys are having an influence in some way on the conversation of what it means to be a classical music organization or an art music organization that is meant to be presenting this living, breathing human experience?
You know, I certainly hope so. And I say that with sort of absolutely no ego in the game, but rather with a totally devout wish that I think the thing which is most important to us becomes increasingly more important to musicians and music organizations everywhere. And that thing actually is individual empowerment. This kind of comes back to the question of diversity and of inclusion on a number of different fronts. But for so long, we've been primarily in a system where you've got, you know, a genius person at the center of an ensemble, tells everybody else what to do. So great, that person says, you do this, and everybody else says, oh, yes, yes, and does it. And you miss so many opportunities for dialogue in a situation like that. This is not just a question of conductor and ensemble. It's also kind of profoundly a question of what does it mean to lead and what does it mean to follow. So even in, for instance, other conductorless ensembles, if you've got fixed section leaders, you've still got the sort of leader-follower dynamic where, you know, one person is saying, hey, section, you people who always sit behind me and who I always lead, please do this thing. And the section says, oh, yes, you know, we'd be happy to. And so what we're really trying to do is to create a situation in which leadership is something, leadership is a privilege every time you get it. And it's a privilege that you get because everybody else is empowering you to take it on. And in the context of a Far Cry, when you're giving that power to another leader, you still feel like totally empowered to do that. When I'm playing in a section, I feel as though I'm enabling whoever is leading that section to do whatever they do. And I know that when I'm leading the section, they're going to have my back in the same way. So, you know, coming back to this question of how do you include all the different voices? I think in large part, the question of how to include them is to create this kind of situation where the power dynamic is so dynamic that every voice feels welcome. Every voice that comes in the door knows that they're going to be welcomed and elevated. And also every voice is going to get asked at some point to participate in this sort of ebb and flow of leading and following. And I would love to see those winds continue to blow across this industry.
I couldn't agree more. Sarah Darling, thank you so much for taking a moment to chat with me about A Far Cry and about your concert, Albion.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.